From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. One of Wilmington's major arteries, Market Street, is named for an antebellum slave market. Bedford Forest Drive in Wilmington honors Nathan Bedford Forrest, a Confederate general and the first Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan. That street is intersected by Robert E. Lee Drive. There are more than a dozen street names in the city that honor Confederate leaders. Wilmington authorities removed the downtown statue of George Davis, Attorney General of the Confederacy, earlier this year after they determined it was a public safety hazard amid Black Lives Matter protests. Another nearby statue honoring the soldiers of the Confederacy, also erected during the Jim Crow era, came down in the pre-dawn hours that same day for the same reason. The population of Wilmington, North Carolina, according to a 2019 U.S. Census Bureau estimate, is about 76% white and slightly less than 19% black. 122 years ago, the black population in Wilmington, then the largest city in North Carolina, outnumbered whites at 56%. People who've lived in the Wilmington area for any period of time have likely heard about, perhaps even read about, the bloody coup d'etat on November 10, 1898, that killed black citizens, drove black elected officials out of office at gunpoint, and eradicated what had been a thriving black professional class. Today, on Eastwood Road near Market Street, a billboard reads, 1898. 2020. Vote. One of the activists responsible for the billboard, Reggie Shuford, executive director of the ACLU in Pennsylvania and raised in Wilmington, writes, "The parallels between black voter suppression then and now are undeniable, and the efforts have never stopped. They have never wanted you to vote, still don't, and think many of you won't. Prove them wrong." How does this bloody coup, which took place more than a century ago, impact Wilmington, the Cape Fear region, North Carolina, and even other parts of the American South today? Is white supremacy still alive and well in the port city? Joining me now is David Zucchino. He's a contributing writer for the New York Times. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his reporting on apartheid in South Africa, and he's written three books, Thunder Run, The Myth of the Welfare Queen, and most recently, Wilmington's Lie, The Murderous Coup of 1898, and the Rise of White Supremacy. He joins me now. David Zucchino, welcome to Coastline.
Great to be with you, Rachel. Thanks for having me on.
Good to have you here. Why was this story available for you to chronicle as one of the few? There are other accounts, but not many, in the 21st century. Why is the only documented coup d'etat on American soil not in the official American history books?
Well, this is a story that was covered up and mischaracterized for almost a century, beginning with the white supremacists in Wilmington and in North Carolina who planned, orchestrated, and carried out the coup. In the years immediately after the coup in 1898, these leaders were really proud of what they had done, and they left memoirs, they wrote articles, they wrote each other letters bragging about what they had accomplished. After that, when the next generation came along, they stuck with the false narrative that what had actually happened was a black race riot. That was the narrative the white supremacists had created, that blacks were arming themselves and planning to rise up just before the election in 1898 and murder whites and take over the city. And that was the narrative they stuck with, and that gradually faded away, and the incident just faded from the history books. It was barely mentioned in North Carolina's public school textbooks, and when it was depicted as this victory for good, clean, honest government and the restoration of power into the hands of the white gentry and the white leadership that had ruled Wilmington up until 1898 or up until the early 1890s, and was just described as a good government initiative that got rid of an illegal and corrupt government.
You go into great detail in your book about how the news media, including the national news media, portrayed this series of events that way as a positive, you know, return of law and order. But I don't recall you talking about history books in North Carolina, textbooks. So you're talking about what has been available to students in the public school system?
Correct. I quote in the book from several passages from textbooks from the 1940s and the 1950s. Again, really promoting the narrative that blacks in the government, this was a mixed race government, there were blacks and whites running the government, that the blacks were incompetent, they weren't educated enough to run a government, they were completely corrupt. And unfortunately, from the point of view of the white supremacists and the way this is taught, that the whites had to rise up and prevent the blacks from murdering white people and taking over the government.
So we're going to talk about some of the lingering repercussions of 1898, things that are still visible today. But first of all, when you embarked on your research for this book, did you run into any pushback or any difficulty? Or is that a phenomenon that other writers about this event have kind of, you know, that has sort of faded from view and there's no longer a resistance to the facts of the coup?
No, there really wasn't much pushback. But what I was surprised is whites and blacks, both descendants, really did not have a clear picture of what had happened. Back, you know, more than 100 years ago, most of it came from family lore. Much of it was inaccurate, and particularly on the white side, they accepted the white narrative. But when I pressed them for details, they really, really didn't have any. There were only very few that could give me specific examples. But as far as pushback, no, people were willing to talk, but in many cases, they just did not know the details.
Okay, so for those folks who don't know the story of the coup d'etat that happened in Wilmington on November 10th, 1898, let's start with the rising white fear of a black rebellion. You write that North Carolina was actually an existential threat to white supremacy everywhere. Why?
It was because there were 18 counties at that time in eastern North Carolina, and each one had a black majority, including New Hanover County and Wilmington, which, as you said, was then the largest city in the state and the most important city in the state. And the white supremacists who had ruled Wilmington up until the early 1890s, when a so-called fusion government took over that united poor white farmers and Republicans, both black and white, took over city government and the state legislature. And the white supremacists who had been used to dominating the state, and particularly the most important city, Wilmington, realized that if black men were allowed to vote and to hold public office, by sheer weight of numbers, they would overwhelm what was then a white minority. As you mentioned earlier, it was 56% black at that time, the city of Wilmington. So this was an existential threat. So they created early in the spring of 1898, which is a midterm election year, what they themselves called the white supremacy campaign. They were very open about it and promoted it. And their goal, it was twofold. One was to prevent black men from voting ever again, and secondly, to keep black men from holding public office ever again. And they were remarkably successful in both endeavors.
And tell us about local government at that time.
At that time, three of the 10 city councilmen, they called them aldermen then, were black. 10 of the 26 police officers were black. The county treasurer, the county coroner, the county jailer were black. They were black magistrates, again, black police officers. There was a thriving black middle class because freed slaves after the war were drawn to Wilmington, which was the most important city in the state. It had a thriving port with lots of jobs. It was a railroad terminus. There were plenty of jobs on the railroads, and in the pine forests around Wilmington, there was the naval stores industry, which was the biggest in the world. And this was they produced pitch, tar, turpentines, and items like that. So there was a wealth of jobs, and that brought this working class blacks or freed slaves who eventually moved up into the middle class. At the same time, the city attracted a thriving black professional class. There were 60-some, by 1898, 60-some black professionals. These were lawyers, doctors, teachers, professors, and funeral home directors. So it was really an outlier in the South at that time. There was no other city in the South that had such an embedded black middle class, professional class, and most importantly, blacks in positions of governance, and blacks with the, at that time, almost unhindered ability to vote. So Wilmington was really, really unusual, and it was really a grand experiment that was thriving at the time up until the events of the spring, summer, and fall of 1898.
And you write about the fact that white Southern men were already feeling emasculated, and the rhetoric over miscegenation or white women sleeping mm-hmm. with black men had started to enter the public dialogue. This had been a fear. Why were white Southern men feeling so emasculated at that point?
Well, first of all, they had lost the Civil War, and that was very emasculating. They had been in positions of power, and then they were occupied by what they considered a foreign power.
And we're going to expand on that when we come back from this break. You're listening to Coastline. It's a conversation with journalist and author David Zucchino, who wrote Wilmington's Lie about the 1898 coup. When we come back from this break, more about the emasculation that Southern white men were feeling and how that fed into the coup, and also who Jane Cronley was and what role her diaries provided in uncovering what happened. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline, I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Wilmington's Lie is one of the few historic accounts of the coup d'etat that took place in Wilmington, North Carolina on November 10th, 1898. David Zucchino, who won a Pulitzer for his reporting on apartheid in South Africa, is the author of the book, and he's with me now. David Zucchino, just before we went to break, you were explaining some of the dynamics that went into this feeling among Southern white men of emasculation. And you said that one of the major factors was having just lost the Civil War. What else went into that feeling, and what made Southern white men so vulnerable to the kind of race baiting and fears of miscegenation that happened?
Right. Yeah, I mentioned losing the war and being occupied by Union forces. And as a result of losing the war, obviously slavery ended, and black men, as I'd mentioned earlier, flocked to Wilmington, and they were given the right to vote and the right to hold public office. And this was incredibly threatening to white men. They feared that if black men were elected and elevated to public office, that they might think that they were socially and culturally equal to whites. And if that were the case, then they might prove attractive to white women. And that was something that the white men could not bear. They could not even bear the thought of it. As you mentioned earlier, miscegenation, which is the word they used for, quote, race mixing, that terrified them. They believed the races should be forever separated, that whites were intellectually, morally, superior to blacks, and blacks were put on the earth to serve whites. And as long as they, quote, knew their place, things were fine. But with black men in office and in positions of authority, that was incredibly threatening, and they were not going to allow that.
So Alex Manley was a man who had a mixed race, a man of mixed race. He could pass for white, but he insisted on identifying as a black man. He started a newspaper in 1887 to serve as a platform for progressive ideals and black empowerment in Wilmington. And that's when the campaign against black empowerment really accelerated. Rebecca Felton also gave a speech. Can you tell us about her speech and what role it had in these events?
Yeah, Rebecca Felton was the wife of a United States congressman in Georgia, and she gave a fiery speech to a group of Georgia men, chastising them for not stopping what she said was a rape epidemic, rapes of white women by black men, particularly on the farms. And she said the corrective, the solution for this was to lynch any black man caught in any kind of situation with a white woman. And the quote that came out of that that everyone remembered was, lynch 1,000 times a week if necessary. And this enraged Alex Manley in Wilmington, the editor of the Daily Record, which claimed to be the only black daily in the world. It wasn't, but it was one of very, very few black daily newspapers in the country. There were a lot of black weeklies, but not too many black dailies. He was outraged, and the day he read that editorial, he sat down and wrote a response. This was on August 18th, 1898. This is several months before the election. Essentially, he said two things. One, he said most encounters between black men and white women that ended up in the lynching of the black man were in fact consensual affairs, that white women were attracted to black men, particularly because they held these positions of power and influence. And secondly, he said for generations, white men had been raping black women with impunity. And that just outraged the white community. You have to remember at this time, the white supremacy campaign was already well underway, and the newspapers were producing reams and reams of copy, falsely saying there was a rape epidemic and that black men were roaming through the countryside raping white women at will and were not being stopped. So in this volatile atmosphere, Alex Manley writes this editorial. White vigilantes that very day wanted to lynch him and burn down his newspaper. And just to show you how premeditated this coup was, the leaders of the coup said, no, now's not the right time. We can use this to our advantage in November, closer to the election, and really inflame white voters, get more whites out to the polls and get them angry. So leave Alex Manley alone for now, leave his newspaper alone. We'll use this to much greater effect later.
And so a number of different cabals of white men started, they were plotting. So there was this campaign that was launched through the news media about the threat of black men specifically. There was the Group of Six, the Committee of 25, the Secret Nine. So who were all these people and how different were their agendas?
Agendas were very similar. And these were basically the leading white men, the businessmen, plantation owners. It was the white aristocracy, lawyers, bankers, who were not going to abide by what they called Negro rule. And in fact, it wasn't black rule. There were more white Republicans in office than black Republicans. But even one black man in office was too much for this leadership of the white community to bear. So they did break up into these secret groups, but there was nothing secret about what they planned to do. They were very open about it. They announced many, many times that they were going to, first of all, win the election by the ballot or the bullet or both. They made it very clear they would use violence if it was necessary. And then they also made it clear that they would take over the city government. They did have a problem because the midterm election was for federal, offices for the state legislature and county offices, but city offices, where the real political power was, were not up for re-election until the following March. And the white supremacists decided they were not going to wait that long. Their plan was to steal the election on November 8th and have 2 days of what they called planning and waiting, and then launch the coup to overthrow the government on November 10th, 2 days later.
So what were the ways that they were going to steal the election? I mean, you do talk about how the violence actually began earlier as regular intimidation before the election. Tell us about that.
Long before it started in the spring, people need to understand that this was not only a propaganda war promulgated by the newspapers, but it was also a vigilante war. The leaders of the white supremacy movement in the state, and particularly in Wilmington, had their own terrorist militia known as Red Shirts. And these were armed white men whose job during the spring, summer, and fall of 1898 was to ride out through the Cape Fear countryside, burst into black homes at night, yank out black men, beat them, whip them, and tell them if they dared register to vote, they would come back and kill them. So there was a whole summer of intimidation of black men. It even included white businessmen and white merchants in Wilmington who decreed that if they caught any of their black employees registering to vote, they would be fired, and many were fired. So this was a very calculated plan to keep blacks away from the polls, or black men at the time, because women didn't vote. And it involved intimidation and violence. Now, in addition to the Red Shirts, the white supremacists had two state militias at their disposal. And I found this really fascinating. There was the Wilmington Light Infantry and the City Naval Reserves. Both of these were the National Guard of the day. They were supposed to report to the governor in Raleigh for any civil insurrection. But in fact, they were made up entirely of white supremacists, and their commanders were not only white supremacists, but the leaders of the white supremacy campaign in Wilmington. So they had Red Shirts, they had just vigilantes, just armed white men, plus they had two well-armed militias. Both of the militias were supplied by the merchants who raised money to buy the latest weaponry. They bought them two rapid fire guns, what we would call today machine guns. They were one was a Colt, and these were early machine guns that they bought for the militias out of fear that just with ordinary weapons, their Winchesters and rifles and shotguns, they would not be able to handle an uprising by the black majority.
You're listening to Coastline today. It's a conversation with Pulitzer Prize winning reporter David Zucchino, who is the author of Wilmington's Lie, a book about America's only recorded coup d'etat. So that governor to which you're referring, Governor Russell, was a fusionist governor, and which means that he was actually elected in large part by the very people that he gave this. There was unchecked authority to white supremacists to unleash their state troops against. So why would Governor Russell have turned on his own, not only his own constituents, but the people who put him in office?
That was a question I really tried to answer in this book, and I did quite a bit of research trying to get at his state of mind. You have to remember, he was from Wilmington. He was a member of the rice and cotton gentry. His father owned slaves and had a plantation. He knew Wilmington really well, but he was a Republican, and he, as you pointed out, was elected in large part due to a large African-American vote that put him in office. But he was completely intimidated by the white supremacists in Wilmington. Many of these people, a few were relatives, many were relatives by marriage, and most were lifelong friends. And they knew him very well, and they knew how to intimidate him. They threatened to kill him. He kept a pistol at all hands. He had received many, many assassination threats. They also threatened to launch impeachment against him in the legislature if he didn't go along with what they said. So I think he was completely cowed. didn't have the backbone to stand up to the very people he grew up with and his closest friends and the people of the same social strata, as much as he had benefited from Black votes. He turned his back on the Black voters on November 10th when the time came to make a decision. And we can talk about that in detail if you'd like.
Yeah. So talk about this, the moment that the white cabals, the red shirts, forced elected officials from office at gunpoint, and how the violence of that day unfolded.
Yeah, it began November 10th, about midday. White gunmen were coursing through the streets. They had been called there by Colonel Alfred Moore Waddell, who was a former congressman and who was the leader of the mobs that day. And they had part of their plan early in the day was to burn down Alex Manly's newspaper and lynch Alex Manly. And that morning at the Wilmington Light Infantry, all these armed men gathered and marched to the newspaper, which was closed. The staff had fled. Alex Manly had fled. He had been warned that he was about to be lynched, and he was given the password and $25 in gold coins and managed to get out of town. But the newspaper was burned. The sight of smoke coming from Brooklyn, which was this neighborhood in what is now called the North Side in Wilmington, which was mixed race on one side, but much of it was African American. The sight of smoke coming from that and the fire bell for the fire at the paper terrified the Black community, and Black wives of workers at the Sprunt cotton compress right downtown, where 800 Black men worked, rushed to warn their husbands. They thought the city was being burned down, and they saw white gunmen coursing through the streets. So these men rushed home, gathered at a corner. They confronted the white gunmen. The Blacks had very few guns because white merchants in town refused to sell the Black men. On the other hand, whites had spent the summer arming themselves with pistols, shotguns, and Winchesters, and the stores actually ran out of weapons and ammunition, and they had to call for reinforcements or extra ammo and guns from Richmond and Baltimore. This confrontation happens at North 4th Street on a corner, and the whites opened fire first. Three Black men fall dead, and then the so-called white revolution and the coup and the basically a planned murder spree is underway.
What do we know about how many people died? This is one of the questions that has been foggy and essentially unanswered. I've heard estimates ranging from 9 people to hundreds. How many people died that day?
Many Black descendants put the number in the hundreds, and they point out that many Black people ran out into the streets secretly and grabbed the bodies of their dead family members and secretly buried them. The state established a commission to look into this in the early 2000s, and they spent 5 years, and their best estimate was at least 60 men were murdered that day, at least. And that's the number I go with, but no one knows the true number because it was a very chaotic day. And, death certificates were not issued at that time, and there was no accounting. There was an attempt at an inquest, but it turned into a joke, as I describe in the book.
There were other kinds of casualties in these events, including, well, first of all, let's talk about the exodus. The people who weren't killed, many of them fled for their lives that day. And you go into great detail about Black families hiding in the swamps in the freezing cold November, starving, getting sick. And there was some point when some Black families were coaxed out by after most of the violence had ended by some of the white power structure, or, you know, mouthpieces for the white power structure. But there were a lot of people that just fled and never came back. How many do you think that was?
Well, on the day of the coup, if you can imagine the terror that must, of course, through these Black families, they see their men actually shot dead on the street. They're terrified. They ran from their houses with the clothes on their back. They figured the safest place was to get out of the city and get into the woods. And many went for Pine Forest Cemetery, which was a Black cemetery. And they thought maybe the white gunmen wouldn't go there. And they spent 3 days and two nights there before they were coaxed back by the white leadership, who realized they needed Black workers. You know, things weren't getting done, businesses were closed, and they wanted these Black workers to come back. And they did come back, but almost immediately in the days and weeks after the coup, Black families fled en masse, and the estimate is at least 2,100 Black people fled Wilmington and never came back. And this is out of a population of about 11,000, just under 11,000 Black people. So that's quite a big percentage of the population that left and never came back.
Now, there have been discussions about reparations, and part of the issue around reparations with this is that it's been next to impossible to establish what wealth, what property was co-opted by whites or stolen from Blacks by whites. And you've written about how this myth of theft can really be dispelled. But what happened to all that property? Because you know, we've got this thriving Black professional class, thriving Black middle class. They left behind homes and money, probably, and other kinds of assets. So where did all that go?
They did. They were able to take money and possessions with them. And I was surprised to find that an academic researcher in Wilmington spent a long time going through property records and came to a very startling conclusion that there was not a widespread stealing of properties by the whites.
Right. You're listening to Coastline. It's a look at the fraught racial history in Wilmington, North Carolina, with author and journalist David Zucchino. When we come back from this short break, a look at what else remains from 1898 that's visible in 2020. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. David Zucchino won a Pulitzer Prize for his reporting on apartheid in South Africa for the Philadelphia Inquirer. He's a contributing writer for the New York Times, and he's the author of three books. His latest, Wilmington's Lie, chronicles the events leading up to the bloody November 10th, 1898 coup in Wilmington, North Carolina, which terrorized Black residents into fleeing the city, murdered an unknowable number of Black men, and eviscerated the Black middle class. So, David Zucchino, just before we went to break, you were explaining why you've concluded that Wilmington's whites sought to rob Blacks of their civil rights, not their property. If about 2,100 Black citizens fled, leaving behind homes and other property, where did all that wealth go?
I was really surprised by the conclusions that were drawn by an academic researcher at UNC Wilmington, who went through property records from 1898 and onward to try to find out what had happened to the properties of the people who had left. And what she discovered that was, by and large, there was no mass appropriation of these properties by white supremacists or white authorities. As you mentioned, the goal of the white supremacy campaign was to prevent Black men from voting, to prevent them from holding public office, basically to rob them of their civil rights, not of their property. Essentially, what she found in her research that was, in many cases, the black owners of these properties either gave or sold to relatives the properties, or they sold them or gave them to other African Americans. I mean, there were a few cases of whites stealing the property, but it was not widespread, which again really surprised me.
So do you understand then why that myth has perpetuated itself? I mean, you look at Wilmington today, and not only do you see not even a 19% black population here, it's mostly white people, mm-hmm. but it's also extremely segregated, and it's been hard for a black middle class to really get a foothold here. And I've heard anecdotally from black professionals who've moved here and then since left that they get here and see things and see the segregation and the Confederate monuments, a couple of which have come down, and the street names, and say, okay, not a place I want to raise my kids or build my career. I mean, so you're saying that that wealth, which would have been considerable in 1898, really remained within the black community.
Yes, but the economic base was ripped out from under them, particularly the middle class. Just before the coup, the night before the coup, or the day before the coup, 1,000 white men met at Thalian Hall and issued the Wilmington Declaration of Independence, in which they said Negro rule was over. Henceforth, all jobs would go to white men. Black men would not have their jobs. They disbanded the black fire departments. They fired every black city employee. So even though the actual properties may have remained in the hands of many African Americans, the economic base was ripped out from under them. There were no jobs, so there was no way to accumulate wealth. And like you, I have talked to black professionals and black middle class people in Wilmington who do not feel welcome in Wilmington because of the segregation and because of the attitudes and because of this history of robbing black citizens of their fundamental civil rights. It is known as a city that is hostile to African Americans, even 120 years later. So it is not surprising to me at all that black middle class and black professionals would not feel comfortable in Wilmington, would not want to move here and raise their families here.
I want to talk to you in a moment about some of the descendants of the victims of 1898 that you spoke with. That's an absolutely riveting part of your book. But Jane Cromley, she was this white Wilmington resident. And in a couple of parts of your book, you quote excerpts from her diary. How did you come upon her diary, and what kind of perspective did that give you into the events of 1898?
Yeah, Jane Cromley was a middle class, probably upper middle class, white woman who lived in downtown Wilmington, and her brother had been dragooned into serving in these sentinel patrols that the white supremacists created during the summer and fall of 1898. He was forced to go out armed with a Winchester and patrol the streets to prevent this black uprising that the white newspapers and the white leadership was preventing. And she was just outraged by the way her black neighbors had been treated during that summer, and at the violent militarization of her own city, and the hatred that was spewed forth in the newspapers and by her white neighbors. And she wrote at length about this in her diary, which I found at the library at Duke University.
Now, Faye Chaplin is the great-granddaughter of Thomas Miller, who was a very wealthy black entrepreneur in Wilmington. He was one of the folks who was banished, considered a threat to white rule, white supremacy. And he was never permitted to return to the city, even for his mother's funeral, which actually was heartbreaking for him. And he just died a few years after her death, in his early 50s, I believe. But you spoke with Faye Chaplin, his great-granddaughter, and what did she tell you about what she learned about the events of 1898 and how she feels about it today?
Well, first of all, Thomas Miller is both a tragic and a fascinating character. He was one of the wealthiest men in Wilmington, black or white. He was a shrewd businessman. He made a lot of money in real estate. He had a restaurant and a saloon. He had been a deputy sheriff early on. He was well respected in town, and he loaned money to blacks and whites. And many people speculated that the reason he was singled out in particular, not only for his wealth and his prominence, but because white men owed money to him. And on the day of the coup, he was taken at gunpoint by the militia in a wagon and put in the city jail to be banished the next day. And the white supremacists had what they called a banishment campaign. That was the term they used. And they selected the leading black figures of the city, the ones that they didn't murder, in addition to the leading white Republicans. And they considered them all a threat to white supremacist rule. And they rounded them up at gunpoint, marched them to the train station, and said, get on that train, leave Wilmington. If you ever come back, we will shoot you on sight. And not one of them, black or white, ever came back. Now, Thomas Miller was among those who was banished. And when I talked to Faye Chaplin, she was almost in tears because of, first of all, how little she knew about what happened to her great grandfather, to his properties, to his money. She had no idea where it all went. She didn't know the story. And she was just hurt and outraged by how openly and nakedly racist the white supremacists were. These were her great-grandfather's neighbors, men that he indicated in his letters he thought his friends, and he assumed they respected him, and he was rounded up like a criminal at gunpoint and forced to leave the city. As you mentioned, he wrote and I think 1901, you know, only a couple of years after the coup, that he wanted to come back to Wilmington. He was living in Norfolk, I believe, and asked permission to come back for his mother's funeral, and it was denied, and it would just broke his heart. And there is a plaintive letter that that Faye has that was written by her great grandfather, which is just so touching and so painful to read, but it's included in the book. And I really think that experience broke him. And as you say, he died about a year or so later. He was just a broken man. He was crushed.
Now, Hugh McRae, one of the masterminds behind the coup and a member of the group that composed a white Declaration of Independence for Wilmington, also donated land for a park in Wilmington. This has been a big topic of conversation here. And over the years, it's been a cyclical thing. The question of do we rename the park has come up before New Hanover County Commissioners. They recently voted to do that. And it was a split vote. They changed the name to Longleaf Park. Two commissioners, Woody White and Patricia Kusek, who are not running for re-election and will be completing their terms this year, voted against that change. Number one, are you surprised that since this comes up periodically, but has never really gained any traction, that it happened this year? And what do you think about the fact that it was a split vote?
I'm surprised it took this long. But I think the white community has been very, very reluctant to face, you know, the true narrative of what happened in 1898. And I am sure there are many white people who wish it would all go away. And I did get that reaction from some whites when I went to Wilmington to talk about the book and to talk to people. Their question was, why are you dredging this up? You're creating racial hatred. You're bringing up stuff from 120 years ago. There's no need for that. It's pulling people apart. Well, of course, my answer would be no. It's one way to start bringing this city together, by facing what really happened and correcting the historical narrative. The fact that it was a split vote didn't particularly surprise me, because I know there are some very hardcore whites in the community of Wilmington who don't really believe what happened in 1898 was all that terrible. And certainly the white community profited economically and politically from what happened then. As you know, Hugh McRae, when he donated the land for the Park, he stipulated that it was for whites only, and it was for whites only for many years during the whole Jim Crow era. I would have thought after the Jim Crow era, it might have been renamed. And as I understand it, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, his granddaughter or great-granddaughter has approved of the name change.
Yes, that's right. And there was also a formal apology. There have been other attempts at reconciliation without changing the name. But I just want to point out that in 1899, a year after, the municipal elections in Wilmington showed how well the voter intimidation and suppression worked. You write that only 21 of Wilmington's black citizens registered to vote. Not 21%, 21 people. And only five turned up at the polls, which I think demonstrates the depth of the trauma that they underwent because of this. But I want to go to 2013. The U.S. Supreme Court cleared the way for North Carolina to pass some laws, some voter ID laws, kind of reconfiguring some of the rules. Voter ID, by the way, is not required in the 2020 election, but it will be required if nothing else happens in the court by next year. What decision did the Supreme Court have to make before North Carolina could pass some of those laws in 2013? The voter ID
this
law
was
specifically.
This was a momentous decision. You have to remember, from 1898 up until the mid-60s with the passage of the Voting Rights Act, blacks in Wilmington and in North Carolina basically did not vote, only in tiny numbers. I'll give you a couple of figures of how successful this coup was. In 1896, there were 126,000 black men in North Carolina registered to vote, 126,000. By 1902, just 4 years after the coup, the number was down to 6,100. So you can see how devastating this was to the right to vote. Now, the Supreme Court in 2013 ruled that the pre-clearance provision of the Civil Rights Act, which meant that most of the counties in North Carolina and many other southern states had to have pre-clearance from the Justice Department if they made any changes in election procedures. They removed that pre-clearance the very next day, the white leadership in the state legislature in North Carolina announced that they were going to pass a voter ID law. And they had done their research. They went to the state elections board and asked, how many blacks had driver's licenses? How many black citizens had birth certificates and proper identification? How many blacks used early voting because they had to get off from work and were able to use black early voting to vote? And they ask how many blacks used souls to the polls, which is early voting on Sundays organized by a lot of the African-American churches. And they designed the voter ID bill to cut those very advantages that African-Americans had been enjoying. And so they very clearly tried to suppress the black vote, and a federal court overthrew the voter ID bill, saying that the white legislature had targeted African Americans with surgical precision.
You talked a little bit about the fact that even today, Wilmington doesn't come across as a super friendly place for people of color, and there the vestiges of 1898 and the segregation remains. How do you, as a guy who won a Pulitzer for your reporting on apartheid in South Africa, and then your research on this bloody coup in 1898 and the torture and harassment of people of color before and after November 10th, 1898, how do you process this as a white man yourself? What do you make of it? I mean, do you ever get to the place where you just think white people are inherently evil and this is just what they do around the world? There was the Holocaust. I mean, how do you put this in some kind of understandable context with your own
identity?
First
of all, I feel a little uncomfortable sort of speaking for black middle class people and black professional people on why they don't want to come to Wilmington. But I can certainly see the historical record, and I can see the amazing ramifications of this coup and how long it lasted. First of all, in preventing black men from voting and keeping them out of public office.
And that is this edition of Coastline. David Zucchino, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. It was wonderful to be with you.
The book is Wilmington's Lie, The Murderous Coup of 1898 and the Rise of White Supremacy. Coastline's producer is Rachel Keith. Technical director is Ken Campbell. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media, and Andrew Craig engineered this edition. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org. Get the podcast, find it on the HQR app. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.